This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we find out how an IKEA collaboration continues to bring the work of contemporary artists into our homes. We visit the factory of British heritage brand Sunspell to find out how they craft fine-fitting t-shirts. Plus, esteemed designer Richard Poulin tells us about one unsung hero of modernist graphic design. And we have a design news dispatch from the southern United States. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Since 2015, IKEA has collaborated with contemporary artists to create IKEA Art Event Collections. The project brings artist-led products into the homes of customers all around the globe. With each collection based on a theme, this year's focus centers on the intersection between art and functional design. To find out more, I spoke to Henrik Most, IKEA's creative leader, and Sabine Marcellus, a Rotterdam-based designer that created a lamp for the new range.
IKEA is a design company. We work with democratizing design for the many people. Done that for ages. But we also think it's important with art as a way of communicating and creating conversations with people's emotions, fantasies, and experience things with your senses. So it's not like stepping away from the functionality. It's more combining function and emotion when we do a collection that is based on the meeting between design and art.
And Sabine, you've been tasked with combining function with emotion. I can't imagine that's particularly easy. Could you take us through the brief that you received from IKEA and how you interpreted it?
Well, to be honest, there wasn't really much of a brief, which is awesome. So I think actually there wasn't really a brief. It was just more, what would you design as an object for IKEA? Together, we sort of decided on a light. It's obviously something I do a lot in my own work outside of this collaboration with IKEA, to play with light and the interaction of light with materials. So it was a really cool challenge to try and translate that work into a more mass-producible version for IKEA.
And Henrik, you know, you're working with, you know, very well-known artists and designers and people whose works sell for a lot more than what I imagine you're going to be marketing them at through IKEA. So I guess you have this principle of democratizing design and you're doing something similar with art. But how do you actually physically do this?
I mean, there are two answers to that question. One is looking at the product development process at IKEA. I mean, how do we take on an idea which evolved quite organically with Sabine, thank God. It was really nice. That's, of course, how we work with democratic design overall. You know, principles about form, function, quality, affordability, sustainability. These are guidelines. And through those, we can manage at creating affordable objects or products. I mean, we have 75 years experience, so we're quite good at it at this stage with honoring the art. It addresses two things. And one thing for me is the idea of art as being one unique object. You know, this kind of modernistic idea that art is only art if it exists in one piece. And I don't buy that premises, I must say. I think that's kind of very elitist way of looking at art. After all, art has been, in many different occasions throughout the centuries, been reproduced since the Industrial Revolution. And look at what Warhol did with the Brillo soapbox. That was not original art. That was a reproduction of a soapbox that already existed. So, I mean, it's a question that I find a little bit, to be honest, boring, because I think we are outside that zone where we talk about art as the aura of art being this uniqueness that is almost untouchable. I think we live in a time where it makes sense that art should be accessible and available for people no matter where you live in the world.
Sabine, just going back to the piece that you've created, I'd love to hear about how you took your traditional process and worked with IKEA to be able to bring something to life that could be mass produced and could cost less. What was the actual process like doing that?
Yeah, I had to take a little bit of a step back and not work from the material so much, but more thinking about how can the shape of a material influence light instead of the interaction of the material. So yeah, I don't know. In the beginning, I just decided that I wanted to work with maybe a minimum amount of material, also from a sustainability point of view. So it was always going to be like a single sheet, and how could you manipulate this sheet to have really interesting lighting effects. So it was a lot of paper models, folding, cutting, and then, yeah, ending up with this, you know, pure form with a slash through the front face so that the light is both able to bounce back from behind the sheet, but also sort of peek through the front face.
In my eyes, it's a really beautiful piece. And Henrik, everyone has their own personal taste. How do you kind of inform people about the value of art in the home, but at the same time, you know, don't try and be too specific about what makes good art?
Art is subjective. It's always been. It's an never-ending story. I think allowing people to judge by themselves what they like and what they appreciate, I think, is, for me, liberating. And that's also why we work with different artists and designers who work in different ways and have different aesthetical signatures. It doesn't matter how functional a product is, there's always a shape. Otherwise, there is no product. And that shape has aesthetical connotations, no matter how you twist and turn it. I mean, Dieter Rahm said that he wants his design to melt into a concrete wall. It shouldn't be visible. And of course it's visible. It doesn't matter how minimalistic or how objective you try to create a design, it still has an aesthetical connotation. And I think that's part of the deal when you buy something. You buy from a functional need, but you also buy with your emotions, you know, your senses. And of course, when you buy art, you might buy it more from your senses and not from a function, you know. But it depends on the artwork. If it's an artwork that's supposed to interact with, or it's a sculpture, or it's a painting, or what we do. So I think it's the arena or the scene for art and design today so rich that I don't think there's any given answers. There are suggestions.
Sabine, just finally, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Henrik's talking about in terms of generating emotion from the work. What are the elements of it that you feel is going to create that response? And what response do you hope people will get from it?
Definitely my aim with this lamp is that it allows for spaces to be transformed through a changing color. The lamp really lives as quite an anonymous object when it's not turned on. It's subtle enough to blend into a space, but then it makes enough of a statement when it's turned on to be able to transform this same space. And you have the option to curate what color you want the space to be. So there is a cold white light, a warm white light, and then there are three different hues of this more like orange and coral and pink. Yeah, I really hope that through this lamp, especially now we're all spending so much time in our homes, it's nice to be able to transform that space from a daytime working mode into a more cozy or all the way to party mode space just through changing the color of the lamp.
Sabine Marcellus, and before that, Henrik Most. My thanks to them both. The clothing manufacturer and retailer Sunspell is renowned for its continued production of high-quality garments. We sent this show's researcher, Nick Manise, to take a visit to their factory and discover how the brand continues to build on this rich heritage.
Most English cities in the 19th century built their reputation by doing one thing and one thing well. For Nottingham in 1860, the year that Thomas Arthur Hill founded British heritage brand Sunspell, that was lace making. The son of a hosier, it was only natural that Hill followed his father into the trade before establishing his own factory in the city. Soon renowned for making lightweight and soft clothing, Hill pioneered the development of luxury undergarments with Sunspell, a family-run business until 2005. This tradition continues today under the direction of CEO Nicholas Brooke, 8 miles down the road in Long Eaton, where the brand moved in 1929. And it's from this location that designers have worked side by side with those on the factory floor, producing fine garments, and in the process popularising the t-shirt and boxer short in the UK. To understand how this relationship between designing and making plays out, I popped on my boxer shorts, and some trousers too, before heading to Long Eaton to meet David Telfer, Sunspell's creative director.
So this is our archive room. So it's quite nice that we've got quite a hands-on archive. A lot of different fabric swatches that would have been developed on the old warp knitting machines back from Nottingham. A lot of the old advertising as well. There's definitely been quite a few different brand marks used through the years. And a lot of garments as well. It's quite interesting. Most of them are undergarments, but there's some very interesting designs in here. Kind of some a bit more quirky that I don't see today, but also some that are really like relevant and seen today and have obviously gone through fashion or in different ways.
Do you have a favourite item in the archive?
My favourite one is one of these Henleys, and it's not a fabric we use now, but it's called Celliloc. So it's quite a fabric innovation, but in terms of its wool on the outside and a cotton mesh on the inside, and it would have been used for very early thermals. It's quite an interesting design piece, and this is actually just various bits where it's kind of been folded in and kind of stitched back. It's quite an interesting thing you get from working as a manufacturer. In terms of they make things in a specific way that would be the most kind of functional way to make something. So I think that's something I quite admire with some of these pieces. They're obviously designed, and then there's a conversation between the person sewing it and the person designing it, saying, actually, if you made it like this, then it'd be much easier to make or nicer to make, nicer finish, which you can definitely see in some of these pieces in the archive.
And it's this sort of relationship between designer and maker that continues today, with local production helping to ground the brand in the UK.
So we've been in this actual building for over 80 years, mainly making T-shirts and underwear, which gives us a real speciality. And I think that's one of the things of UK manufacturers. They tend to specialise in one or two particular things. For Sunspell, in terms of what we make here today, it's mainly the T-shirt. And one of the things that really makes it quite special is that we get involved in the whole process. The fabric we're trying to make is lightweight, soft, and kind of very easy to wear, but it's actually very difficult to work with. And one of the special things here is that they actually they just know how to work with that fabric, because we specialized in mainly using that fabric here. They're specialists in working with that fabric and making it as beautiful as possible, the finishing and detailing around it. The skill level of the ladies in the factory is unbelievable for a product that is usually seen as basic or simple. It's kind of anything but when you actually see them working with it.
It's a sentiment shared by garment technologist Debbie Smith, who I meet on the factory floor. To produce some of the world's finest T-shirts, there's no room for error, which means that not a single step from the hemming to the neck binding, or even pressing, is automated.
A lot of factories do automated cutting, the computerised cutting, but we just follow all the old-fashioned methods. The girls are very skilled in what they do. We get complete accuracy. So
it's this hands-on approach, combined with the proximity of the brand's design studio, which sits in a building directly adjacent the factory floor, that helps to ensure the quality of Sunspell's work, with communication between the two quick and effective.
As a designer, being able to know the people that are making your products and have a dance with them at Christmas parties and different things like that, and actually know them in an actual genuine way is really special. Because that's quite rare in the industry, to design something. You might know the factory, but you don't know them in a more relational way, which is really nice and special. It's another level of detail, because it's from getting the fibre through to the knitting, through to the dyeing, through to the delivering, to all the small things that happen in a factory in terms of day-to-day. And understanding that when I design a product is really unique. It's a very different process to just sending out a sketch to a factory abroad, and it's that makes it such a special process for me as a designer, but also for the whole business, that we can be really proud of the product that we create here.
And judging by Sunspell's increasing number of beautiful and surprising collaborations, other designers are drawn to this process too.
We tend to want people to come and visit the factory, firstly because to see the archive and see the history and elements of that, and then also just to meet everyone down there. I mean, we had a great trip before lockdown. Paul Weller came down, and it was like a really lovely day for them, but also for him. He just loved the factory and the feeling of it, and as a customer himself, he kind of suddenly saw, actually, this is genuine, this is where it's made and what it is. And I think there's something about working with artists, both them seeing where we work and also us seeing their studio and how they work, And building that relationship becomes a much more special collaboration than an email collaboration, which is fine, but it's not the same kind of emotion to it. When both parties are invested in a collaboration, it definitely becomes something different and special.
So, what's the outcome of this special production process? Well, if 160 years of demand for its products, a place in pop culture, and a spot in the wardrobe of the discerning is anything to go by, it's the ideal way to make quality clothing that stands the test of time. For Monocle, in Long Eaton, I'm Nick Manise.
Thanks to Nick Manise for that report. Next on the show, we are heading over to the United States for a design news dispatch. This week, we hear from Monocle correspondent Sarah Rowland, who covers the southern states in the US. So to begin, Sarah, New Orleans, the colorful southern city, is becoming a bit more colorful in terms of its design scene. Can you tell us what's happening on the ground there?
Yes, absolutely. So essentially, the city of New Orleans has recently celebrated the 15-year kind of emergence from Hurricane Katrina, which was such a crazy and chaotic period of time. But out of that kind of wreckage, a lot of times there are wonderful things that can happen. So over the past 15 years, the city has truly experienced this kind of slow, continued growth. However, in the past year, it seems like a lot of local businesses and designers have kind of found this way to kind of bring their designs to the forefront. There's companies like Dorman Design and Goodwood, who are both these kind of really essentially sustainably driven furniture and architectural fabrication companies. And they're really seeing this emerging kind of scene for them to bring their products into more production as well. Both companies have seen the situation where their staff members have doubled in size. And they're really saying that that's contributed in part to this creative trend that's going towards embracing these sustainable methods of production.
And is that kind of a character of the people there? I mean, what is it about the culture of this place? I understand, you know, it's quite a vibrant and diverse population there. But what are the aspects of the city you think that are kind of feeding into this creativity and this focus on sustainability?
You know, I think that because it's such an art-focused community, it's always been that way. And there's kind of eclectic atmosphere there. So everything is welcomed. You know, any kind of eccentric craft or different kinds of things are always welcomed in the city. But I do think that because of, you know, those different catastrophic things that have happened in the past, they're kind of looking towards these new methods of how can we actually be better to our environment? How can we elevate our sense of design into this more high design world, but also do it with a way that pays, you know, tribute to our environment and protects it as well?
And maybe we'll move across to Charleston, another kind of exciting city. From what I do understand, you know, there's manufacturing of design products happening there at a pretty serious rate, including a company called Urban Electric. What's happening here? And, you know, how important, I guess, is this for the city's economy? You know, manufacturing is so important in a lot of ways. U.S. cities have kind of lost out as more manufacturing has gone offshore. But it sounds like these guys are pumping things out at their production facility.
They actually have also been celebrating, this is their 15th year in business, but they've mentioned that this was one of the years of the most production that they've ever seen, which is really exciting to see that kind of unexpected growth during a period, you know, like this past year. Charleston has always had this culture of just really pays tribute to Southern culture in a lot of ways, but it also has had this element of elevated design, which a lot of people aren't aware of. Most of these Southern cities have a lot of land and a lot of infrastructure where they actually can have big manufacturing warehouses and things, as opposed to a New York or somewhere like that. In places like Charleston, they're really in line with this trend for being able to produce at a higher rate and keep up with this higher demand that's coming in terms of the manufacturing and production situation as of today. I know throughout a lot of these kind of manufacturers have mentioned that throughout this past year of the pandemic, people are wanting to really restructure and redo their homes, their interior spaces, as well as commercial spaces.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was in Italy recently speaking to a lot of the furniture companies there, and they were all saying they've kind of enjoyed growth in the US over the last year. And obviously these guys are based in Charleston are going through something similar. Is that something you've kind of seen across the board? There is this desire among American people to think a little bit more about their home and bring ideas about good design into these places.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's partly because we're spending more time in our homes and in our workspaces, you know, trying to create these workspaces from home and make them a little bit more elevated in terms of design and just more comfortable, but also beautiful. All these kind of manufacturing companies and people that are creating something beautiful, it's just something that people can stick into their homes or their workspaces and really feel a little better because design makes us all feel better.
I don't know if I feel better, though. I'm just looking at all these stories you've sent across and everything just seems so lovely and sunny, particularly this high design development called Kaya Beach in Florida. Could you share a little bit more about this super, super beautiful space?
Absolutely. So 30A essentially in Florida is a place that is very much well known for Southerners, especially the Southeast kind of Southern community, as like the hotspot for holidays and vacations. So over the years, it's always been this beautiful place, but not as idyllic in terms of design and that higher level of intentional, thoughtful design. You can imagine kind of candy colored houses and large, big resorts that, you know, thousands of people can stay in these high rises. But with Kaya, they've started this new production and it's essentially going to be this gorgeous, I would kind of reference the Aman Hotel Group, something that's very much more exotic and a departure from what's already there in 30A. So it's really going to be set apart from everything else in terms of design. They have this amazing branding company that's done this gorgeous aesthetic and created this beautiful look and feel called Clarity from Alabama. It's going to really be known for this quietness and this peacefulness that you'll feel when you go there. And it's just going to really elevate that design community as well, because it's not something that's really been seen there before. So it's going to be a beautiful development for sure.
And do you think it's a little bit of a, I guess, a reflection of like we were talking about before, you know, a higher appreciation of design, but also maybe due to this circumstance of the pandemic and people not so keen to travel down to Mexico or fly across to Europe, and they want to holiday internally in the US, but they kind of want this escape through amazing design at the same time.
Absolutely. Yes. People want to feel like they're transported somewhere else and just get that feeling of an exotic destination. And right now, since that's not so available, being able to bring that to Florida in a way that attributes to its history in the right ways, but also moves it forward and brings along this new aesthetic in terms of architecture, interiors, and urban planning, that's going to be a wonderful addition for that 38 highway.
My thanks to Sarah Rowland there. She is a Monocle correspondent and she covers the southern states in the US for us. We stay in the United States now for our final item. The publishing platform Volume has launched its first retrospective of mid-century modernist graphic designer Rudolf de Harrach. Written and designed by former de Harrach studio partner Richard Poulin, the book tells the extraordinary story of a self-taught designer whose work is still revered to this day. I recently caught up with Richard to discuss the book and the impact that Rudolf had on him and his career.
He's one of the, I feel, unsung heroes of modernism in graphic design, especially from the beginning of his career in 1947 until he retired, not only in terms of graphic design, but he was a very influential design educator at Cooper Union and at Yale and at various institutions and graphic design programs around the United States. I always felt that he needed due recognition.
I think for a lot of people, if you say the word modernism to them, they might think of, you know, mid-century architecture, they might think of an Eames lounger, but they probably don't think about graphic design. So how do you kind of describe modernism with relation to graphic design?
Well, it's very much tied to the international style. Everything coming out of the Bauhaus in the beginning of the 20th century, 1920s, 1930s. And while many people may be familiar, as you just mentioned, the Eames chair or Mies furniture or Mies architecture, there was also what was called the international typographic style that came out of the Bauhaus, as well as Switzerland and Germany around the same time. So it was very much identical in terms of the philosophy, the approach, and the tenets of modernism. And while the majority of this was developed in Europe in the 20s and 30s, it started to come to America with several European emigres prior to the Nazi regime in Germany and so many of these creative forces, such as the architects Mies, Walter Gropius, people of that nature, Laszlo Mahalinage, coming to America. And that really set the path and the road, so to speak, for American modernism to really take off. And Rudy, fortunately for him, in the late 1940s, was very much influenced by this new movement in the States.
I've got some of his work in front of me at the moment. Absolutely gorgeous, but there's a real simplicity to it as well. You know, could you perhaps describe his style and the way that he did communicate with graphic design?
You know, if you think about design history in the time frame that I've just mentioned, especially in the 40s and 50s in America, Rudy was also very much influenced by abstract expressionism, De Stijl, Dada, all the art movements of that time period. You know, this is a man and a creative force that, you know, he didn't have any formal training in graphic design. He was all self-taught. And he was very fortunate to be influenced by not only those individuals I mentioned earlier, but all these other creative forces around him. While he was influenced by other graphic designers at the time period, he really wanted to find his own language, so to speak, and what he called the hidden order. He didn't really lock into one style. It was more about the content, whether it was music or it was literature or narrative or things of that nature. And he tried to find the hidden order within each of those stories and then re-articulated it visually, if that makes sense. So he was very much a purist in that way. I worked with him for many, many years. He would cringe if someone said, "What's your style?" because he was very much against that. He felt that the content, the story, was the most important thing. And he truly believed that out of understanding that content, that you would find the perfect solution. He was very fortunate in the early stages of his career with Westminster Records. The record label president of Westminster gave him a lot of freedom because this was a time when everyone was rethinking how record album covers should be treated. He was really creating new ground, exploring in new ways. And he did over 50 covers in the early 60s. And then at the same time, with his McGraw-Hill paperback book covers, he did close to 400. A lot of that work also showed the breadth and the vast variety of approaches he took. Not because he felt that was his style, but it goes back to my earlier point where he really wanted to explore the content and come up with graphic vocabulary.
That's just the beginning of the body of his work. It spans a long period of time too. You have all of this material. How do you put it into a book?
I felt it would be most important and most resonant to organize his story in a chronological fashion. And while that may be conventional, I think the power of Rudy's story is that his early beginnings, you know, he didn't go to Yale University and study graphic design, didn't have those types of opportunities. He worked in a lower middle class family in Queens and New York City and also growing up in Los Angeles. So the book's organization takes you through that evolution of starting somewhat simpler and more immediate in terms of print, but then going into a more varied and diverse world of three-dimensional work, especially with his exhibition design and environmental and architectural graphics in the later decades of his career.
I guess the biggest challenge for yourself as a graphic designer is creating something that honors his work and I guess maybe has a little touch of your style in it. So how did you do that?
I'd like to think that if he was able to design a book on his own work, it would be very much a similar approach. You know, for instance, just to give you some insights into the way he would approach this and the way I approached it, you know, for instance, the overall size is based upon the golden mean. So I'm going to mention a couple of things because, you know, Rudy didn't approach things in an arbitrary or stylistic way. They all had to deal with content. So when I talk about establishing the width and the height of the book or the format or the size of the book as the golden mean or the golden rectangle, because that's the optimum sort of format to get the most dynamic compositions. I'll give you another insight. Where all the typography is accidens grotesque, which is a typeface that is really emblematic of European modernism and the international typographic style. And he loved this typeface. So that was another way to make those connections. And I think the third is to really show the work in the most impactful and dynamic way so that it just stands on its own without any stylistic devices to enhance it or to detract from it. And I hope the reader will see that.
My thanks to Richard Poulin there. Rational Simplicity, Rudolf de Harrach is available to support now on Volume. And that's all we have time for on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maylee Evans with assistance from Sean Hickey. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Manise and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you for listening and goodbye.